Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I am the host of the podcast titled Revolution Z. This is our 112th episode, and this time we have as our guest Jack Rasmus. Jack wrote the recently published book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. Jack has written several prior books on the USA and global economy, and his articles appear regularly on ZNet and Counterpunch USA, among other venues. He currently teaches economics at St. Mary's College in Moraga, California. For more than a decade, Jack was the local union president, contract negotiator, strike coordinator, and organizer for various unions, including the National Writers Union, UAW, and SEIU, among others. He blogs at jackrasmus.com. He hosts the weekly radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. So, Jack, welcome to Revolution Z.
Glad to join you.
I hope that today you can explain to our audience, and to me too, honestly, something about the stock market and the recent GameStop events. And so, to start at the beginning, what is actually bought and sold on Wall Street in the stock market?
Ownership claims. You don't really buy a piece of paper anymore because it's all electronic entries. So when you buy a stock, you buy a claim on the ownership of a company. And sometimes that gives you some voting rights when they hold their annual board meetings. But usually there's millions of share of stocks out. So if you own 100 shares of a stock, you know, it doesn't make any difference, you know. It's really a farce. You don't really own the company. You don't really have any effective voice or control, but you own a claim to the company. That's what a stock is. And if the price of the stock goes up and you sell it, well, then you get a capital gain. And by the way, nowadays, in the stock market, and for decades already, you can make a capital gain when the stock price falls. That's what we call short selling, and we can talk about that later. But basically, a stock ownership means you just have an electronic claim of a very minimal amount on the company itself.
So in that case, what's supposed to be the link between the price of the stock, what's purchased and sold on the one hand, and the actual condition of the real economy of producers and consumers and products on the other hand?
Nowadays, very little. And for the last several decades, increasingly so. You know, it used to be that if a company made profits and was doing well and was expanding, the value of its stock would go up. And that was the price, the market price of the stock would go up because the company was selling more stuff, making more profits and increasing its wealth. But those days for most stocks are long gone. Not all of them, but increasingly so, all kinds of stock has nothing to do with the performance of the economy and the linkage between a company doing well and its stock price rising is really not the norm anymore. You know, what drives the price of stock up is demand for it, people buying it. It used to be people would buy the stock because the company was doing well. But now that's not true in most cases, and even for zombie companies especially, and that's what GameStop is about, it doesn't matter if the company's doing well or not doing well. People are buying the stock anyway. In other words, the demand for the stock goes up, therefore the price goes up. It has nothing to do with the real condition of that company or the economy.
And in a way, that seems like it has to be the case, and it has to be evident, because it seems like, you know, you watch TV and a movie about Wall Street or something, and these guys are frantic about what's going to happen in the next day or 2 days or 4 days. And it seems pretty clear that the value of the company, the real material value of the company, isn't changing that fast, and yet the stock prices can change that fast.
Absolutely. Another good example of that is the price of oil, right? The price of oil will fluctuate, you know, between $30, $40, $60, $70 a barrel. Why is it doing that? It's not because they're pumping out twice as much oil or cutting oil production in half. It's because you have speculators who are buying claims, called futures on that oil, driving up the price of the oil on stock markets that have nothing to do with the supply and demand of oil in the real world. That's just another example, but these examples are common throughout all of the financial asset markets. You see, stocks are a financial asset. Bonds are a financial asset. But you got all kinds of derivatives, you know, special created phony contracts. And you got currencies. That's a financial market. You got all kinds of financial markets out there now that have really ballooned in the last 40 years. That's what economists mean when you say we have a financialization of the economy. There are so many financial markets with so many different kind of financial instruments and securities that people with a lot of money are playing games. That's why they call it a casino. You know, they're buying. It's like betting.
It seems like it's not even like gambling. And gambling, I mean, imagine you're gambling on the Super Bowl tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're betting on the team and you're trying to discern whether it's going to do well or it's going to do poorly, et cetera, et cetera. But what you seem to be describing is a situation where nominally you're doing that, but you actually are in a position to change the way the game is played and who's and how the teams are playing. I mean, it's more like fraud at the outset. You know what I mean? In other words, They are manipulating the outcome. It's like cheaters at the Super Bowl, somebody who could manipulate the game by buying off a player or something. It's more like that because their behavior is determining what's happening to the stock prices.
Well, you know, maybe another analogy is it's kind of like sitting at a blackjack table in Las Vegas and knowing what the next card or two are going to be before the dealer turns it over.
Or being allowed to put the card on the table.
Sometimes, or being allowed to pick the card yourself, you know. If you're big enough, like a big hedge fund or private equity firm, whatever, you can influence what the next card will be, or even call the next card, like you said. So it's gambling, but it's gambling with the rules of the game fixed.
For the larger and stronger entities to have a distinct advantage gamble.
Yeah, it's like if you were sitting at a blackjack table and you had stakes in front of you that were billions of dollars, and next to you was a guy who had a stake of $100 in chips, you know, he wouldn't be able to call the card next. You would be able because the casino likes you coming in and you're a preferred customer. So, we'll let you call the bet.
Okay. So moving toward the GameStop episode, which, crowded the media the past, I don't know, weekday, 10 days, whatever it's been. What is selling short, since that seems to be what was at the center of it?
Okay. Short selling is, really speculation, speculative betting, speculative investment. Let me define the term speculation here, and then we'll define what short selling is. Speculation is when I buy or sell a stock, or it could be any other kind of financial asset, looking for a short-term capital gain. In other words, I'm buying it or selling it, I'm betting, that the price of the stock is going to change in the short run. And I'm buying it in expectation of that change, which I'm going to then flip whatever I bought real quick. In other words, it's always short-term betting, short-term buying and selling, and I'm going to reap a capital gain out of it. And by the way, you know, since Trump, the capital gains tax has been cut in half. So, it's an incentive to engage in this kind of speculation. It's not like an investor buying a company, buying the stock or the bonds of a company and holding on to it in expectation of, well, maybe 2 or 3 years from now, the company will be doing so great and I'll be able to sell that stock down the road for more than I bought it. It's always, speculation is always a short-term bet and a flip. In other words, reselling it. Now, you think about buying a stock, you think about, I'm buying it at the price today, I'm going to, as a speculator, I hope, you know, within the next 24 hours, the price will rise. It could be even a split seconds, you know, and then I'm going to sell it at a higher price. That's easy to understand and grasp, that form of speculative investing, as we call it. Now, there's a opposite of that, and this is part of how all the financial wizards create all these new ways to make money by buying and selling financial instruments like stocks and derivatives. You know, they've done this over the last 40 years. Short selling, and I'll go slow here because it's not intuitive sometimes. Short selling is when I contact my broker and I make a contract saying that I'm going to sell. I got a contract to sell stock X that I'm buying today, okay? I'm not giving you any money yet. I'm just signing this contract that I will sell that stock at today's price. And I'm betting to myself that stock is going to fall in value over the next week, 2 weeks, month, whatever. And when it does, or before it falls, before, you know, I reach the limit of my contract, I'm actually, you know, going to buy the stock. In other words, I have a contract today in which I'm going to sell it at today's price. And part of that contract means down the road, certain number of time or day, I'm going to then buy it. So when I complete the contract, when I buy it at a lower price, when I short it, right? I've already sold it at today's price. So I have that spread, you see, and that's my profit. So people, you know, these guys in the stock market, they make money when things go up. They make money when things go down. They've planned it that way. And the big institutional speculators like hedge funds, to get into a hedge fund, to be a member of a hedge fund, you got to put up millions of dollars, you see, to join a hedge fund. And the owner of the hedge fund gets 20% of all the profits off the top, plus fees for his administration. You know, you want to really get rich quick, start a hedge fund. So those are millionaires playing the games in the hedge funds. They're the big finance capitalists. They're the big boys. What you got with GameStop is the small speculators. They're both speculators. See, they're both, whether it's the hedge funds or whether it's the day traders, the small guys, relatively small, they're both speculating. They're both betting that they're going to flip the stock after they buy or sell it and make a capital gain and keep most of the money.
Let me just try and clarify a few things, okay? Or ask you a few questions to clarify.
Sure.
Okay, so I say I'm going to sell the stock at the current price, and now days start to pass, and I'm hoping that the stock is going to go down well below that, and then I can buy it at that lower price and sell it at the price I contracted to sell it at, right?
Right.
And then I make my profit. So one question I have for you is, when do I have to make that purchase buy?
Depends on your contract. You can short sell, indicating you're going to do it within a week or within a month, or you could do it any time in between. But when that, let's say the month, when that month comes up, if you haven't bought it, well, then you lose your whole investment, you see.
Or I have to buy at the last minute at whatever the price is.
Yeah. But if the price went up and you had to buy, you're losing all that money, right?
Yes, I understand. Okay. So that's that. Now, one more question. Whichever happens, right? Let's say I make a gain or I make a loss, and we're clear what causes that. So let's say I walk away with $1 million profit. Okay. Where does that $1 million literally come from?
It's an electronic entry. It doesn't come from anywhere until you cash it out.
Okay. So I cash it out. My question is, did somebody lose $1 million?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the $1 million is a transfer of $1 million from somebody or some set of people to me.
Yep. Those who made the wrong bet. In other words, if I'm a big hedge fund and I bet it's going to fall, and then the day traders come in and they drive the price up, and is not falling. And as you say, maybe I buy it at the last minute to minimize my losses, right? Well, then the money I put up goes to the day trader.
Okay. So it really is a transfer of some sort. So let's go back for a second before we do GameStop. In the normal operations of Wall Street, of the stock market, there are all these, I suppose, overwhelmingly they're, at least in terms of the volume of the trades, they're overwhelmingly highly wealthy. And they're making these purchases and sales. And some people are winning. And for anybody to win, somebody else is losing. Is that correct?
Correct. Essentially, right.
Okay. So as a tool for redistribution of wealth, or as a mechanism that causes redistribution of wealth, that's only going to happen in any significant degree, I guess, when somebody keeps winning and somebody keeps losing.
Except the whole pie keeps growing at which people are winning and losing. So how does that happen? Right? Well, that happens because the central bank, the Federal Reserve, pumps money into the banking system, usually the commercial banks. These are commercial banks are more regulated. Commercial banks are like Chase and Wells Fargo and so forth. And the commercial banks loan money to the hedge funds and their equity firms, or what we sometimes call the shadow banks. The shadow banks, like the investment banks and the hedge funds and so forth, are unregulated pretty much. They borrow their money from the commercial banks. Commercial banks get it from the Federal Reserve. And the shadow banks are just where the big players speculate and take big risks because, you know, you take big risks, you make big money. If you take small risk, you make small money. It's just like, betting and poker, right? You play nickel dime, you're only going to make a couple bucks. You play table stakes, you're going to make a lot. So the shadow bankers are the ones who destabilize the economy, because when they are lending money in turn to their clients who are borrowing from them on the margin, we call that margin buying, right? And their clients are then investing in stock. Let's just keep using stock, but you could have the same thing going on with other financial instruments. When the prices go up of the stock and the winnings, in other words, everyone's making a killing in the stock market because prices are going up. We got a bubble, right? And we're borrowing more money from the hedge funds in order to bet more, you know, or some other institution, investment banks, to bet more. And investment banks and hedge funds are borrowing from the commercial banks, and the commercial banks are telling the central bank Fed, hey, we need more money in the economy, so the Fed provides more money. When the prices are going up, right, everything is stable, and this margin buying drives the price even further up. Margin buying, for example, is when, let's say I have $1 million in value of stocks with my broker, right? And the stock market's going up, and I want to invest some more. But I play with the broker's money. The broker will allow me to borrow 20% or more on the value of my stocks I already bought. But if the price of my stocks keep going up, I can borrow more to make that 20%. So I keep borrowing from the broker, and I keep buying, and the stock keeps going up. But at some point, you know, prices fall. And the faster and more they go up, the faster they fall. And when that happens, my broker says to me, you got to put some real money in here now because the value of your stocks have fallen. Well, gee, I got to put in some real money with my broker. I better sell something else I own. And then you got everybody selling to meet their margin call, as it's called, right? And that drives down prices even more, which means they got to sell even more. Now you're in a financial crash. But you see the link, how it goes, you know, from the actual speculator to the institution, the broker who's loaning you money, and the broker and the hedge fund are using margin loans, and they're getting their money from the commercial banks, and they're getting their money from the central bank. It's an edifice that collapses once the prices begin to fall precipitously across the board.
Okay, I got one more question for you before we go on to the GameStop situation. Let's say the prices are going up, the stock market as a whole is going up, the wealth of the people who own these stocks is going up, but the size of what we'll call the social product, right, the actual product that's being produced in society is staying essentially stable, right? It's not going up, or it's not enlarging. Because, as you said, there's very little connection between the stock market prices and the actual real economy. So if that's happening, why isn't, in essence, a dollar steadily worth less and less?
Well, to be worth less and less, you got to have inflation, right?
Yeah.
That's what, you know, drives down the value of your product or whatever it is, right? Well, the way to explain that is that, let's go back to the central bank, the Federal Reserve, giving money, pumping money into the commercial banks. It used to be decades ago, before the economy was so financialized, that the private banks would loan money out to real companies to make real things. And those companies making real things would hire real people who made real wages, which they then use to buy the things, right?
Right.
Well, when
right.
real people have money, income, and they buy things, real discrete things, you know, cars and so forth, and, you know, household things and food and so forth, when they buy more of that, well, the demand for those real things means the price rises up in those real things. But if they're not making money, if the wages aren't rising, in fact, falling, right? Where's the income for them to buy things? They don't have the income. They turn to credit cards as a substitute for that income, but there's limits to that. So you don't have real people with real income buying real things, so you don't have inflation in what we call real goods and services. And that's been the case for decades now because wages aren't rising. Where is all this money going then? Well, as I've argued, the money that's being pumped from the Federal Reserve into the commercial banks, into the shadow banks, into the brokers, into the financial markets, right? The money that the Fed is creating is going into financial markets. Or, in the case of the U.S. with its global economic empire, it's going offshore, which does nothing for creating, inflation or goods or anything in the U.S. economy. We've got U.S. multinational companies now who have tremendous businesses around the world, really expanded under neoliberalism in the last 40 years. So the Fed keeps pumping money into the economy. It keeps going to the financial markets, or it keeps going offshore, or the big companies hoard it, and then they give it to their shareholders in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Under Obama, it was almost $1 trillion a year corporate America was shoveling off into its 1% shareholders. Under Trump, it's been $1.3 trillion a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. So the money creation, in short here to sum up, is going in three places. It's going offshore, it's going to the financial markets, or it's going to shareholders who, by the way, pump it into financial markets or offshore as well. But very little is now going into the real U.S. economy to really build things, to hire people and create wages. Now, there's a few exceptions to that. You know, I mean, you got Tesla making cars, but he's moving offshore to China now, right? And you got other companies, that are maybe building houses. You can't offshore housing, right? And a few other areas of the economy where you still have real investment going on. But we used to have so much more. And that's why we're not creating wages, and we're really not creating jobs, except low-paid, cheap jobs. That's the consequence of 21st century financialized capitalism. This is finance capital is running the show economically. is also running the show politically, because you look at who are the guys who are the Treasury secretaries and the economic advisors to Trump, and before that to Obama, and before that to George W. Bush. Who are the guys? They're the shadow bankers. They're the investment bankers, right? They're the Goldman Sachs running the show economically under Trump, right? Goldman Sachs, Steve Mnuchin, Gary Cohn, this guy Bradley, I think, the head of the Federal Reserve in New York, the most important part of the Federal Reserve, right? They're calling all the shots. In fact, it was Mnuchin and Gary Cohn who together in a back room crafted Trump's $4 trillion tax cut in December of 2017, which the Republicans wouldn't even let the Democrats read, and they put it to a vote. Talk about stuffing it down the throat of your opposition. And that $4 trillion tax cut went through beginning in January 2018. And by the way, it was $4 trillion, not the phony $1.5 trillion you hear so much in mainstream media.
Let's go back or forward, I don't know, to the GameStop situation. First of all, what is GameStop? It's a company, right? What does it do?
Well, it's a company that makes outmoded disc-based video games. You know, video games, you used to buy them, you know, in these stores and plug it into your PC and play your game. Well, now all that gaming is online. You know, none of it's in on disc anymore. Well, GameStop was making the discs. And because it was making discs and there's falling market for those discs, right, the value of the company was collapsing. And the hedge fund saw this and they said, well, you know, that means GameStop is the old technology. It's going to go out of business. GameStop loaded up on junk bonds to try to stay afloat in the last 10 years, like a lot of other zombie companies kept alive because of junk bonds. So, well, it's going to have to decline. Its stock price is going to have to decline, you know, these hedge funders said. Let's short it. And by them shorting it, they gave a signal to the rest of the market, it's going to fall. And that sort of is a self-fulfilling move, you know. And everyone else jumped, not everyone, but a lot of people jump in and they short the stock too, right? And that's how they, the hedge funds, sort of try to garner the market to make a big killing short selling a GameStop. But they were doing it with AMC, the movie chain. You know, no one's going to movies anymore, right? And some other businesses as well. So they had a whole lineup of zombie companies they were short selling. Now here comes the day traders.
And okay, let's just be sure everybody gets it. So on day one, so to speak, the big hedge funds say to themselves, GameStop's a disaster area. So what we're going to do is we're going to make a contract today to sell it for the current price, but we're going to not sell it until we buy it down the road, hopefully for a lower price. They totally anticipate for a lower price, and therefore we will have bought low and sold high, and we'll have made a big profit. So that was their plan, right?
But remember, if you're a big hedge fund and you do that, you send a signal to other hedge funds and other investors that, they must know that the price is going to fall even more. So let's jump in and join them, you see.
Right. So it's a bandwagon effect.
Yeah.
And everybody's trying to make a killing off the failing of GameStop.
Now, let's make a digression on that example. Let's go back to 2008. These same hedge funds are the guys that drove down, short sold the stock of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, drove those stocks down to valueless almost, right? And precipitated the financial crash, or played a big role in doing it. It's the same thing going on now. Except instead of, companies like Lehman Brothers, big banks, investment banks, and Bear Stearns, investment banks. Because the investment banks, remember, borrow all their money from the commercial banks when they have this big run. And Bear Stearns went out of business because its main lender, which was J.P. Morgan, said, no, we're not going to give you any more money. So then Bear Stearns collapses in March. And guess who buys up Bear Stearns? J.P. Morgan Chase, not even with its own money. it gets $28 billion from the Fed to buy up Bear Stearns that it drove into bankruptcy anyway, you see? And the same thing happened with Lehman Brothers later on.
Okay, so back to the present. The hedge funds sell short GameStop. And then what happens?
Well, at the same time, you see, you got changing financial structure going on in 21st century finance capitalism, made possible by technology. You got all these new forms of shadow bankers popping up all over. And there's this other thing called peer-to-peer or crowdfunding and so forth. This is the world of the day trader. Now, you know, don't think the day trader is grandma and grandpa sitting in front of their PC buying 100 shares, right? There are some of those people, but these day traders are very, very well off. You know, they're sitting and doing this full time. You know, they just don't work for a hedge fund. They work for themselves, and they're placing all these bets and so forth as well. And their numbers have become so large because we've had this big 15-year run-up of the stock market, or 10-year run-up. All these people have made a lot of money, and they get together, see? Before, they were kind of isolated making their bets, but technology now, social media, allows them to communicate with each other and aggregate their bets big enough to influence the movement of the price of a stock like GameStop. How do they do that? How do the day traders do that? Well, they have this social platform called Reddit. And on Reddit, there's a forum called Wall Street Bets. And they communicate with each other and they say, hey, you know, let's drive the price of GameStop up and we'll make a big killing here because we'll catch the hedge funds off guard and they'll have to sell. And then when the price goes up, we will then flip it ourselves and make a lot of money. Well, they make their bets. Here's the third institutional element for the day traders. You know, it's the day traders who are on Reddit, who are using the forum Wall Street Bets, and they place their bets with a broker, an online broker called Robinhood. So they've got a system where you put all the day traders together. They have as much weight in the movement of a stock as maybe a couple big hedge funds do, maybe even more. So you got these two speculators, you see. The day traders are speculating in a traditional way. Let's drive up the price of the stock and flip it. And you got the hedge funds speculating on short selling it. So it's a financial food fight going on between these two wings of speculators and finance capitalists. Don't think of it as David and Goliath. That's what the media would like you to think of it. But this is just finance capitalists, two different sectors of it, fighting it out over the bubbles that are growing in these financial markets.
So when the GameStop day traders amalgamated, it seems to me that's not very different than a hedge fund, but anyway, except that it forms and then it...
Yes, you're right.
It unforms and then it forms again, et cetera. But it's basically a conglomeration of actors, like a hedge fund, right?
Yes.
So they drive up the price. Now, driving up the price means basically that you're just buying it over and over again, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so they buy it over and over again. They drive up the price. So let's say they get the price to twice, four times, or 300 times what it needs to be for the hedge funds to make their profit. So now instead, the hedge funds have to buy it at this high price and sell it at a low price and take an immediate bath, right? Is that right?
Yeah, they take a big bath. That's why the hedge funds went to Robinhood, because they own Robinhood. Citadel Securities, a big hedge fund, has a $2.7 billion investment in the online broker Robinhood, and they got Robinhood to stop the buying of the GameStop stock to keep it from
going up. In order to prevent it from going still higher.
Yes. And then the next day, it starts falling. But then, you know, there's a lot of complaints about, well, wait a minute, you know, hedge funds, you know, what are you doing? You know, you're manipulating the market. You're saying that the day traders are manipulating. You're manipulating it too, you know? And all this talk about the Security and Exchange Commission coming in and looking at it and so forth. And other hedge funds start pumping money into Robinhood. Robinhood borrows $1 billion overnight. Oh, I wonder why. Reward, right? So then Robinhood gets the pressure from the SEC and politicians and says, we're going to allow GameStop to start selling. You know, they had put limits. You could only buy 100 shares at a time, and you had a maximum amount. So they opened up GameStop buying, and guess what happens? GameStop goes up again, right? And that's where we are today. Both sides are pushing and pulling and playing on this, and GameStop and AMC and other stock goes up, it goes down. But this is just the churning at the top of the bubble going on here. It's an indication that the bubbles are getting out of control. And that's
right, let's come to that in a second. I just want to ask another question because people have to be able to follow this. So the hedge fund or hedge funds decided to sell GameStop short. And when they decided that, let's say day one, GameStop's price was whatever it was, and the hedge fund decided to sell short, which means they were going to sell GameStop sometime in the future for that current price. And now a certain period of time passes, and if GameStop dropped, they would make money. You may remember I asked at the beginning, how long has to pass? When do they have to make their decision? Well, what I don't understand is if the hedge fund just never buys GameStop because the price has gone too high and they don't want to buy it, then the contract doesn't come due and they don't have to sell it because they don't have it. In other words, no. How do they get forced into taking the loss?
Because when you make the contract, you agree within the time limit, say 30 days, you are going to buy it at the price that you're selling it. You don't have a choice. You can't back out. They don't let you make a bet and not pay up, right?
Right. So at some point in time, you have to buy it at whatever that current price is.
Right.
And then sell it at the price that you contracted at the beginning.
Right. You'd have to sell it at a higher price. You take a loss. If the price of it was driven up by the day traders, you know, you'd have to sell it at a higher price. You know, the price you bought it and the price you sell it would be a loss.
Right. Okay. And so, but my question is, what was that timeline in this particular case? I mean, it's not
it depends
particularly
on the
pertinent for the, you know, the fate of capitalism or anything, but I'm just curious, when do these hedge funds take a bath?
Well, it depends on the price in your contract. I mean, the timeline in your contract. You know, you would say, I'm going to short this thing within 15 days.
And we don't know what it is.
It could be any. It could be a week. It could be a day. It could be 30 days, you know, whatever the contract is.
No, but I'm asking, what was the contract in this particular case? We don't know?
Oh, there's many contracts, you know, of hedge
funds. Oh, I see.
Yeah, investors, many of them.
Does a hedge fund act as a single entity?
Sometimes. Sometimes the hedge fund will buy and short and sell whatever on its own. And at other times, its members... who are just the millionaire, multimillionaire set, will do it, on their part individually. The hedge fund will do it on behalf of its members, and the hedge fund will do it on behalf of itself.
So the GameStop price is right now high, yes?
Yeah, I think a year ago it was like $19 a year ago, and then it shot up to like $400 or $500 or something. I don't know what it is today, but it's well above $19 still.
Right. So apparently they're going to take a bath. All right. Now, so you're saying that the reason why a certain number of people viewing this get all excited is because they think it's 1,000 grandmas, 1,000 small, normal human beings beating the hedge funds. But that clearly is not what's happening.
Well, there are some small players, but no, essentially that's not what's happening. It's one faction of professional speculators versus another institutionalized faction of professional speculators going at it with each other.
Why do you think the media doesn't explain it clearly but rather sort of goes along with a distorted view of what's going on.
Well, it's a more appealing story, you know. It's the little guy. Little guy's beating these big, nasty hedge funds. No one likes hedge funds except people in them because they end up destroying companies. So, it makes a good story.
So, and therefore it sells papers and it sells magazines, and sure. So they pursue it even though it's false. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that that's what was going on, as it's usually going on. Okay, so that's this event, which actually, when all is said and done, isn't all that big a deal, is it? I mean, is there anything in this particular burst of activity that has lasting implications or lessons?
Yeah, it's that technologies created by capitalism in the 21st century are turning on certain sectors of the capitalist, you see. This is all possible because the force of production, to use a Marxist term, technology, is not totally controllable. And one wing of the finance capitalists are using it to attack another wing that never happened before. It's possible now because of, social media and low-fee, no-fee online brokers. So all this is an example of how capitalism, technology, is running amok and destabilizing financial markets, just as technology is destabilizing the political system. We know the role of social media in creating Trumpism, and we know how that's destabilizing capitalist democracies and capitalist institutions. Well, think of what's going on with GameStop and in the financial markets as kind of like a financial analog to what the Facebooks and the Twitters and all the rest are doing to the political system. Technology, major force of production, is the stabilizing 21st century capitalist institutions, financial and democratic.
Okay, so you can imagine. I can imagine somebody hearing you, one person hearing you and saying, hooray, great, destabilizing the evil phenomena that are associated with both politics and economics in our system. So that's one person could hear that. Another person could hear, not so great, if everything gets destabilized, it risks some kind of authoritarian, fascistic kind of takeover. There's certainly no left in position to right the wrongs. And so you could imagine somebody thinking that. And I'm sure there are other things that people can think. People seem to be able to think all manner of things nowadays. So let me ask you, in the short term, and not 2 days, but in the relatively short term, what do you think would be reforms of value, of merit, in the realm of finances, stock sales, purchases, etc.? What kinds of reforms might be fought for and won that would have desirable effects?
Well, the dangerous thing on the financial side is finance capital and all the speculation, and that structural change in finance capital that is diverting real money capital that would go to invest in real things and create jobs and incomes, diverting it to financial asset markets. What you've got going on in the Federal Reserve now is not monetary policy that stabilizes a destabilized economy and helps it grow and recover. What you got is subsidization of finance capital going on the monetary side, pumping more and more money into them. I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, and where I talked about that. And then in my latest book, Scourge of Neoliberalism, it focuses a lot on the fiscal side because this tax system is subsidizing wealthy investors as well. In the 21st century, that's what fiscal monetary policy is increasingly about, making the rich ever richer, not stabilizing the economy or helping it to grow. And we can see that the latter is not happening as a result. So what kind of reforms or changes? I think we need a public banking system. We need to reform change the Federal Reserve so it's not the handmaiden of the bankers, but that it is a institution that is democratically elected. The decision makers would be elected, not appointed by the bankers, because that's what they vet and do. There would be a system of public banks at the state and local level. And that all these rich people, if they want to play their speculative games, it should be totally divorced from this public banking system. Totally divorced. Let them go and have their casino and steal from each other, but not get any money from the Federal Reserve, not get any money from the banks. Just let them play in their own playpen, you know, and shoot each other if they want.
So it does become a big game of poker.
Yeah, right. But they're borrowing public money to do it, you see. That's right. The problem. And in fact, at the end of my book, I had a chapter, what kind of legislation and what kind of a change to the Constitution, constitutional amendment, would be necessary and useful to do just this, to totally reform. And it's a reform, you know, a revolution would be to put them all out of business, right? But, a reform would be to democratize the Federal Reserve, create a public banking system with the Fed at the top of the structure, all the way down, you know, to your local post office that could be your local bank, postal banking or whatever. That would be a big reform. And I'm not talking about legislation like they used to have to divorce the shadow banks from investment banks from the commercial banks. You know, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about not a wall, but a total severing of the two parts of the monetary banking system. Because the one where the money is, where the capitalists are, is always going to distort and destroy the public side of what banking and monetary policy is all about. So that's what I would do on the financial side. And that would be just the start. I would tax the living hell out of them. I propose that in different ways. You know, you could raise $500 billion a year in this country by putting just a 1% tax on a stock trade, a 10 cent tax on every $1,000 bond trade, just pennies on trading of the $5 trillion a day currency markets, you could raise with a financial transaction tax, you know, elements I've just described, you could raise hundreds of billions of dollars a year, because that's essentially a retail operation, right, in which you have no sales tax. The stock market is buying and selling, but there's no sales tax there. Oh, but you go and buy food, you got a sales tax. So that's the second thing I'd do. And third thing I would do would be to put controls on international money capital flows the way we used to. And also put limits on credit cards. You know, it used to be a 7% limit on credit card debt. Now it's like 30%, whatever. There's all kinds of things that could and should be done to stop this. On the financial side, then there's a whole bunch of things you can do on the real side of the economy as well, you know, like turn the upside-down tax system back on its feet and other things as well that I've talked about before, usually in appendixes to my books.
Okay, well, we've gone now for a while. I'm wondering if you have anything else that you'd like to cover before we sign off.
Well, the thing is to watch what happens here under the Biden regime. You know, is this going to be a continuation of subsidizing finance capital and all capitalists by means of the tax system and by means of the central bank? Are they going to actually try to institute a stimulus? Because we've had no stimulus here in over a year. We've had a couple mitigation bills. Minimal, designed to buy a couple months. And of course, the media totally misrepresents what's been going on in that regard, too. For example, they say, oh, we spent $3 trillion last March in the CARES Act. No, no. Only $1.3 trillion got into the economy, $500 billion there for unemployment benefits and $600 billion and so for small businesses. The rest of the money, including $650 billion in tax cuts for businesses, did not get used, did not get into the economy. The $1.7 trillion in loans to medium and large business that was supposed to be borrowed to save jobs never got borrowed, never got used. So we had a minimal stimulus last March, and then McConnell and Republicans stifled any real stimulus after that until things got so bad in the fourth quarter, where the economy pretty much just flattened out again. They passed another mitigation bill of $900 billion. And now what do we got? Is it going to be a third mitigation bill if the Republicans can slap it down? And if Biden is more concerned about bipartisanship than actually pushing through his American Rescue Plan, as he calls it, $1.9 trillion, will he do that? Can he do that without getting budget reconciliation? No, he's got to have budget reconciliation, but can he get budget reconciliation when you got blue dog Democrats like Joe Manchin in West Virginia and the Sinema of Arizona, who will make sure that the Democrats don't have 50+1. We are at a very critical juncture. I've been writing all year long saying, hey, we're in a triple crisis. We're in a health crisis, and that's not going away. We're totally messing the whole distribution of this thing, and we got these variants coming. So that part of the crisis, COVID keeps going. We've got the lack of a real stimulus that I talked about and the economic crisis, and we could see a contraction, double dip of the economy this quarter. And we got a political crisis, triple crisis going on. I see no real resolution to any of them at this particular point. And the longer it goes on and the economy does not recover, the more likely, to get back to our main theme today, we will see a fourth crisis, and that is a major financial instability event that could happen.
All right. Well, on that optimistic note, I guess we should bring this to a close because we're almost at an hour. We're just under an hour. So thanks, Jack, for coming on and explaining all that to us. I appreciate it myself, and I'm sure the listeners do too.
They can keep up with me. Just keep checking my blog, jackrasmus.com. And, I throw up three or four comments a day on Twitter at @drjackrasmus. And then my weekly radio show, Alternative Visions, on the Progressive Radio Network. I follow all of this pretty closely and will continue to do so.
Okay, then thank you. And this is Mike Albert. And I'm signing off for this episode of Revolution Z. Until next time.